dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this
week you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The society created by the growth imperative of industrial capitalism has no future, and its past and present have already delivered misery aplenty. This week, a tale of two towns seeking paths to an ecologically sustainable and personally satisfying future. One of those towns is more than 1,000 years old, Totnes in Devon in England. The other is still coming into existence in Missouri, an experiment in open-source ecology. Permaculturist Rob Hopkins is regarded as the founder of the Transition Towns Movement, a collaborative grassroots project to relocalize and prepare the places we live for an energy descent society. In 2007, Rob did an interview with the Ecological Options Network that was brought to my attention by Alex, a listener in the UK. In it, Rob explains how the project of Transition Town Totnes evolved to become today a growing movement of towns and cities around the globe.
Well, for the last 10 years, I was living in Ireland, in the southwest of Ireland, and was very involved there in teaching permaculture and eco-village development and natural building and a very sort of hands-on, solutions-based, educational kind of approach. And was set up one of the first eco-village developments. They got planning permission in Ireland, built the first cob buildings, built there for quite a long time and did lots of that kind of thing. And as part of that, also set up the first two-year full-time permaculture course in the world at a college in Kinsale in Ireland. And it turned out that in September 2004, the first day of term, somebody gave me a copy of this film, The End of Suburbia, which I didn't have a DVD player, so I'd not seen. So I thought, I know, I'll show it to the students on the first day of term. And it turned out that just up the road was where Colin Campbell lived. I'd never actually heard of him before, but a friend of mine who'd already seen it said, oh, you should get in touch with Colin Campbell. He just lives up the road and he's in the film. So I'd, not knowing who Colin Campbell was, or not knowing anything about Picol, I just rang him up and said, hi, I wonder if you might come in and talk to my students in Kinsale. He said, certainly, certainly, certainly. So he came along, and so the first day of term they had Colin Campbell and The End of Suburbia. So it was quite an impact on them, really. The concept of transition towns originated with the work that we did in Kinsale, where after we'd had this double whammy from Colin and The End of Suburbia, and everybody was sort of reeling and thinking, my God, where did this come from? You know, I'd been involved in environmental things for 15 years and I'd never caught the idea at all. I just thought, I had this idea that one day in 2050 someone would put the last drop of oil into a car and it would be this gentle thing. But with the second year students on the permaculture course there, we started thinking about, well, what does this mean for the town of Kinsale? How is Kinsale going to adapt to this? You know, we could just sit here, not do anything, let this unfold as a series of lurching crises, or we could actually try and pull together all the different aspects of the town and really, really look at this. Because if we're able collectively to design a way through this using our intelligence, our ingenuity, our creativity, then there's no reason why the future with less oil couldn't be a preferable place to the present. That's really where the idea originated, was in a very, very simple idea, and it's still at its heart is the very simple idea that the future with less oil could be preferable to where we are now. Because, you know, when you actually look at what if you look now in countries like India, there's this process that's going on of trying to vilify the rural, vilify the simple, vilify the kind of pre-industrial, the local, and trying to really rubbish that. And it's a process that happened when I was living in Ireland. It happened in Ireland in the 60s and 70s, all the old buildings being pulled down, people being, you know, that horses and carts were no good, and supermarkets and so on. The same process happened here in the 40s and 50s. So the idea emerged that actually, you know, the future with less oil could be preferable, but that we need to, we really need to rediscover what was actually good about the life before cheap oil. You know, that actually, like us, we've had this whole process of vilifying that's been the case around the world, but actually part of this is looking back to what was good about this. And in Totnes, what we've been doing is a series of oral history interviews with old people of their memories from life in this town between the 30s and the 50s, you know, when cheap oil really came in and really started to change things. And when you do that, you find out about, you know, how resilient people were in those days, how everybody could had skills they could turn their hand to. Dig for Victory, Victory Gardens, I think it was called in the US, wasn't it? You know, that was possible in those days because everybody knew how to garden. They hadn't been to gardening college, but they knew by osmosis how to garden. Nowadays, if you said to people, here's a spade, dig a hole, you know, you'd have lots of people who could design the hole. There's lots of people who could quantity survey the hole and spec the hole up for you, put the hole digging out to tender, and they could ensure the hole digging process against public indemnity, all this kind of thing. But actually, there'd be very few people who would actually dig. You know, so we've really moved away from being a very sort of hands-on, practical kind of society. So the transition towns process is really about trying to look to draw what was good about life before cheap oil. And also not to romanticise it, but that there is a lot that we can learn from that. So we're trying to apply the best of the old, the best of the new, but it's really a process of us getting people to ask the right questions, I think, is a very important part of it. You know, when you look at a town like Totnes, all the plans that the local government draw up, local development plans, community development plans, they're all based on the assumption that climate change won't happen significantly for an ignorable amount of time, that oil prices will always remain cheap, that the move away from the sort of household economy will continue, that will become less and less useful in that sense. And all of those things are really highly questionable. And this process, the transition town process, I really like to think of as being a catalyst, that you come into a town, it's a catalyst for getting people to think about this process. You know, ask the right questions. On the front of our flyer, there's just the question, can you imagine Totnes beyond oil? You know, and that's really the question this process is asking. We don't claim to come in with all the answers. Maybe in some of the questions there aren't actually any answers, you know, but I think it's about coming in with the question rather than breezing in with lots of experts who'll design everything for everybody. It's really a question of unleashing the collective genius of the community around you to engage in addressing this hugely important question. The process of doing a transition town is one of trying to engage all the different sectors. I think, you know, people like Lester Brown talk about the challenge that peak oil presents as requiring a response like a wartime mobilisation. The Hirsch Report talks about a crash programme. You know, the scale of what we have to do is something we've never ever done before. And as environmentalists, I think the tools that we've had up to this point are inadequate. You know, we've never managed to have mainstream engagement on very much, really. So we're really looking at new ways of doing it. When we start in a town, really the first stage is awareness raising, trying to get people switched on to the idea of peak oil depletion. And for me, I think peak oil is a much more powerful tool for engaging people in thinking about these issues than climate change. Because peak oil, as Richard Heinberg puts it, people are more instinctively interested in what's going into their car rather than what's coming out of the exhaust pipe. You know, it's a fuel in problem rather than an emissions out problem. And peak oil is very powerful because it's like putting a mirror up to a community and saying, where's the resilience gone in this community? Where is this community's ability to withstand shocks? And, you know, particularly when we look back to the 30s and 40s, we see that actually then we had that resilience. We had a vibrant local economy. We had local food. We had local agriculture. The car park you see over behind us there used to be, up until the early 1980s, a market garden run by a man called George Heath. And he had five or six glass houses running down the hill on the south-facing slope. It was recorded as being land for growing food on back as far as the Doomsday Book. And there was a cattle market at the top of town where the manure would be scraped off, composted, and then he used it as part of his market gardens to grow flowers, fruit and vegetables, which were then sold in the town in a shop right on the high street, which you can see just behind you. What's important about the model that you see in the garden that was here behind us was that it was... Was that it was a very powerful, dynamic form of urban agriculture. And in countries like Cuba, where they actually have experienced the effects of peak oil, they've started to move much more to these urban land use models. So what we had here was the perfect post-carbon, zero food miles, low energy form of agriculture. Food being grown where people live and then brought to where the people are. You don't have to go back very far. But so I suppose the first stage of doing the transition time process is the awareness raising, which here we did for about a year of talks, film showings, networking with existing groups, trying to do talks for as many diverse groups as possible. And then I like to think of that as being like, do you know those toy volcanoes that children have where you put vinegar and bicarbonate of soda in and then they froth up all over the table and stain the carpet and those things? It's a bit like that you spend your first year putting that in until you've built up this pressure. And here, by after a year, there was really this energy behind doing something. And then that's when we have an evening that we call the official unleashing of Transition Town Totnes, which was the evening designed to be the evening that historically people would look back to and say that was the evening when it all started. We had 400 people came along. The mayor of Totnes introduced it. And it was very, very powerful, dynamic evening. And that really has created a lot of momentum that has driven us forward ever since. But I think it's really important that the momentum, the drive for this, comes from individuals rather than from local authorities. But what you're creating is something which then interfaces with local authorities in a way that few things have in the past. And I don't know about, I imagine in the US, but I know in the UK there's this real sort of split between people in government who think that communities don't care, they're apathetic, they can't be bothered, and the communities who think the government aren't interested, the government don't care, and there's very little dynamic interface between the two. And there are various initiatives that have tried to do that, but I think the transition town model really tries to focus the mind on the question that local authorities can't ask, you know, in a sense. Local authorities, it's very, particularly the ones who need to be elected every year, for them to say, well, we're actually planning for the end of cheap oil and for relocalisation. That's a scary leap for them to make. Whereas if you've got the voice coming up, which has really thought it through and developing plans at the local level for how that's going to work, I think you have a really dynamic interface there. And the replicability of this model on different scales is one that we're still exploring, really. I mean, Kinsale was about 2,800 people. Totnes is about 7,000 or 8,000. My sense is that this process works on a scale over which you feel you have a sphere of influence. So London, for example, is too big. On a small village scale it would work, although if you have too few people I would imagine it's hard to generate sufficient energy behind doing it. And it's still what's happening now is that, inspired by the Transition Town Totnes model, we now have 8 or 9 different transition towns around the country, some of which are small villages, some of which are cities. So we really have models over the whole spectrum, so it's intriguing to see how they do it. My sense is that in urban areas you're looking at working on the neighbourhood scale, and the city I grew up in, Bristol, in the southwest of England, like a lot of other cities, is basically historically a collection of villages that have merged together and that have those distinctive elements to them with their own identity. And so I think the idea is that you work at that scale, so you have transition Clifton, transition wherever, the different parts of the town, and then you have a transition city Bristol body whose role is to support, train and resource those different initiatives and try and inspire them. I think it seems to work perfectly with Totnes is historically is a market town, and I think those market towns work very, very well because they're of a scale where they have a hinterland which is quite defined. You know, the villages which would historically have brought their produce into the market towns, that sets sort of a surrounding kind of a region for it. I mean, it is still an evolving part of this, but I think my gut sense is that it has to work on a scale that you can conceive of, a scale where you can get your head around, where you can appreciate how big it is, and if it starts to get too big, you break it down into its parts. Really, I think it's something that people will just get a feel for wherever they are.
So, in like Havana, people started raising. I think they're raising 60% of their vegetables now in the city, even though it's a city.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think that, I mean, the whole question of urban agriculture is going to really, really play a huge, huge part in the future here. And it's really a luxury of the age of cheap oil that we've been able to put food production off miles away in tidy little sheds and where we don't have to see it, and our urban landscapes are completely devoid of anything edible. You know, one of the things that has always really struck me is, you know, over the last 20, 30 years, if you go to new developments like business parks and shopping, out-of-town shopping places, that we've developed this way of landscaping where we've bred plants specifically to be completely useless. Low-maintenance ground cover shrubs. What is the point of a low-maintenance ground cover shrub? And flowering cherry trees that just make flowers and no cherries. You know, I mean, we've got so far away from common sense, it's terrifying. And one of the things that we're doing in Totnes is launching a project that we call the Totnes, the Nut Tree Capital of Britain, where we want to plant walnut trees throughout the town and really put in place an infrastructure of productivity throughout the town. You know, why is it that we have a townscape which is full of trees but you can't eat any of them? What's the point of that? You know, we could actually plant walnut trees, sweet chestnuts, which produce as much carbohydrate and protein per acre as walnuts, as barley and wheat and so on. And they lock up carbon and they're beautiful and things can live in them and so on. You know, but we could put those in through the town as an infrastructure that's there. Behind me is Vere Island, which is right in the heart of the town of Totnes, and this is a place where, in a couple of days, with the mayor of Totnes, we're going to be planting 2 walnut trees and 5 almond trees, as a way of instigating and launching the Nut Tree Capital of Britain project. So they're going to be very vigorous hybrid walnuts and almonds. And we should get a lot of press coverage with this and get the whole idea of urban productive trees on the map.
Now, has this become has this been adopted and embraced by officials and officially?
The in Kinsale, the energy descent plan we did for Kinsale was adopted by the town council. It was unanimously voted for by the town council, which was quite amazing. And then it won a big environmental award in Ireland that year as well. The process here has had a lot of support from various members of the town council and the local authority. In fact, next week I'm doing a talk to the town council on their invitation, and part of that is to invite them to pass a motion officially endorsing the objectives of Transition Town Totnes. The mayor has been very supportive. She spoke at our opening. She's also going to be planting some walnut trees with us in the middle of Totnes in a couple of weeks. So yeah, there is a lot of interest from people. I mean, what we want to do is to take what was called the Totnes Community Plan, which was developed over a period of time, and take that as the framework to develop into an energy descent plan, because it drops the word sustainability in here and there, but it really doesn't understand what it means. And actually, it would give us, in terms of increasing Totnes's resilience, it does nothing at all. But it is also, it has a lot of recognition. So if we can get an energy descent plan in its place, but using the same format, you know, we'll be kind of harnessing a lot of the power that is within the local authority. Although The End of Suburbia is a fantastic film and really, really totally transformed my way of thinking about all of this, I think the title is somewhat misleading, because suburbia, as James Kunstler says, is, you know, the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world, but at the same time it's there, that's what we have. And David Holmgren, who's the co-founder of Permaculture, his approach is to argue that we need, rather than it being about the end of suburbia, or as the sequel is called, the escape from suburbia, you know, it's more about retrofitting suburbia, redesigning suburbia, rethinking suburbia. You know, in some ways there's good things about suburbia in that you have larger gardens and so on, and that there is the land there if we can start to think about it, to really rethink that in a very productive kind of a way. What's been interesting here, looking back historically in Totnes to back to 1945 at the end of the war, is that the buildings were inhabited in a completely different way. Buildings that are now just one family living in a five-bedroom house in Totnes, or a building which is now offices. Every room of that was a family living in there, you know, and the buildings were inhabited in a completely different way because that was the need at the time. And I think we have to look at how we re-inhabit suburbia. You know, do we just have one family living in a huge house, or actually can that house be broken down into bits and made much more energy efficient in that way? So I think it's rather than thinking that we can just ditch all the infrastructure that we have in place, you know, we don't have that luxury. And I think it's one of the weaknesses of the permaculture alternative lifestyles movement, for example, is that we focus so much on a natural building movement, is that we focus so much on new build. And actually we have, in Totnes, for example, you know, even if we had the most amazing systems of local building, there's a handful of new houses built here every year. Planning is so hard to get and there's so few spaces to build that the challenge is how do we use local, natural, sustainably produced materials to retrofit buildings like this, which are vastly energy inefficient. So it's not a case of abandoning suburbia or escaping from suburbia. I think it's a case of coming back to suburbia with a new way of looking at it, and with new insights, new imagination, and new creativity. When we produced the Kinsale Energy Descent Action Plan in 2005. We printed 500 copies. We didn't think we'd get through 500 copies. Well, who's going to want to read this? It was a student project, but they all went very, very quickly. In fact, I think about 100 of them went to Australia. Somebody just ordered 100 in a box, so they all disappeared over there. Then we put it on the net, and people could download it. It's been downloaded nearly 4,000 times, and different community groups all over the world are using it as a template and as an inspiration for doing their similar sort of projects. So the Transition Town Totnes initiative really began properly September last year, September 06. And since then, there's now 9 different transition towns around the country, and there's new ones getting in touch all the time. And it really there's something very viral about it, that it's really a simple concept, but it's a concept that's really of its time, and that people can get to feel so despondent with climate change, with peak oil particularly, people who have young children for whom the next generation is something tangible sitting in front of them at breakfast every day, and there's something about the concept that really does seem to engage them. So there's now probably the most advanced ones, the Transition Town Lewis in Sussex, who have their official unleashing on the 24th of April. They've done some really brilliant things, like there's a little 5-minute short film that one of their members made about Transition Town Lewis, which is on YouTube and various places.
Don't know what to say about that.
And they have the local cinema showing that as the trailer to every film in the 3 months running up to their official unleashing, which is brilliant. And they also they're involved in a campaign to stop a part of Lewis being developed by a developer and made into something ghastly. And rather than being out there protesting and saying, we don't want this, we must stop this, we must campaign against this, they've come at it from a very different way, the sort of positive solutions way, where they produced this newspaper article written by a journalist called Mavis Happen, that was a newspaper article from 2017 that was talking about how Lewes was now the most sustainable town in the UK. And it could all be traced back to this inspirational development that took place on this piece of land in 2008, which then triggered the whole economic regeneration of the town. There's the town of Stroud in Gloucester, transition town Stroud. They're very moving ahead very strongly, and they're looking at doing, that used to be a textiles town, lots of textiles produced there. So they're looking at how they could revive textiles as part of a relocalisation initiative, local currencies. Transition town Falmouth in Cornwall, there's transition Penwith, which is an area of Cornwall. They're actually now looking at amalgamating and doing a transition Cornwall on a bigger kind of scale for the whole county. There's the city of Bristol, who are sort of breaking Bristol down into its different parts and looking at that. And I had a phone call the other day from Transition Isle of Wight, which is an island off the south of England, which is all rather interesting to do it on that kind of scale. So it does seem to have a momentum behind it as an idea. And as I say, it's a very simple idea that the future with less oil could be better. And I think climate change campaigning and environmental campaigning really struggles because to engage people, because actually it comes from the angle of, you'd better change because it's going to be really, really desperately awful, you know. And the supposed motivator for change is sheer terror of how ghastly everything is going to be. And you have people like James Lovelock out there saying, nothing any of you can do can make any difference to this. This is just happening and we're doomed and we're finished. And people instinctively just shut down, I think, when they encounter that. They shut down completely. You know, what can I do? I can't do anything. It's just beyond me. Whereas the transition town approach says, this is could be fantastic. You know, actually, life beyond, who says life without oil is going to be awful? Actually, you know, there are people in the world who live on a tenth of the oil that we use in the UK, and arguably have a more fulfilling lifestyle. You know, but we've just become so blinkered that we have to have, in order to be happy, we have to burn lots of oil. And I think that the power with the transition town approach is it's sort of gently taking people's hand and saying, come on, you know, we can go through this and we can transition this, and actually it can be fantastic. Somebody asked me a question at a talk recently. They said, you know, well, what will we do if the Gulf Stream shuts off and the UK plunges into an ice age?
Right.
I said, I have no idea. It's a bit like asking, you know, well, the Earth's about to be hit by this huge comet. What do we do? You know, well, there are certain things. You know, if it gets to that stage where the UK is plunged into a perpetual ice age,
mm-hmm.
well, then we've had it, really, I guess. You know, but mm-hmm. actually, I suppose the argument is that if you can get CO2 emissions down underneath, keep them under the 2-degree thing, and then start to stabilise them from that point onwards, then there's a chance that doesn't happen. You know, obviously, if we get into runaway climate change, you know, I think the thing is that if you, in order to avoid the worst excesses, in order to come in under the 2 degrees, then we have to have this wartime mobilization scale of things that we've never had before, and then, you know, then we can do it, I think. But obviously, if we tip over 5, 6, 7 degrees, you know, there's no, transition towns aren't really going to be much help, really. But it's really, you know, I think in order to engage people, there's a thing in the UK that's just happening now where the UK government has proposed road pricing on the roads, kind of a toll on the roads in order to sort of start managing traffic numbers and reduce traffic, which is kind of like road rationing in a sense. And one of those sort of right-wing newspapers organised this petition, and they had 8 million people sign this petition. You know, and you think, you know, we have to have carbon rationing, and we really need carbon rationing now. And if this is what people are, if this is the response to that, what would it be to carbon rationing? And carbon rationing will happen inevitably. If you have a depleting resource, at some point you have to ration it. The sooner you ration it, the more equitable the process is going to be. But the question is, you know, for me, I think that part of the thing with transition towns is it's really kind of softening people up at the grassroots to rather than saying, rather than, because it's a fear response. You know, if you say, we don't want road rationing, we're going to sign a petition, we want to keep our cars. You know, but if you have a very gentle process saying, sorry, it's not going to be, actually, you know, the cars, we have to let go of the cars, but we have to rethink what we're going to do instead. And actually, the future without cars could be far, far preferable to the present with all these blooming cars everywhere. So I think that's the answer, really. Obviously, I mean, at the moment, you know, it is possible that we could heat Totnes, keep people warm sustainably. It's not possible that we could have them all driving hundreds of miles to work every day. You know, and I think that's part of the process with the Energy Descent Plan is, you know, well, here's a diminishing energy base. Do you actually want to use this energy doing frivolous, pointless, ridiculous things? Or are we actually going to spend this on the essentials, which is keeping people warm at an affordable price? George Monbiot is a writer here who's one of the leading environmental writers here. He wrote a book called Heat, which tried to set out very practically how the UK, emitting only 10% of its current emissions by 2030, what it would look like, how we would actually do that. So it looks at energy, food, transport, a whole range of things. Very interesting. I don't agree with all of it, but the thing that was disappointing about it was at the end, he has this chapter about how we're actually going to do it. There's this massive, unprecedented scale on the scale of gearing up for World War II, you know, within a very short period of time, engaging all these different parties, constituencies, different vested interests into this thing. So the tools that we have in that are activism, lobbying, and protesting. I would argue that actually those are the only tools really the environmental movement has had for the last 40 years, and they haven't been sufficient for the scale of the challenge up to this point. And to imagine that they're on their own are going to be sufficient for the scale of what we have to do now, I think it's not going to happen. So what we're really exploring in the Transition Town movement is new tools and creating a synthesis of new tools which draws from creative teaching approaches that we use in permaculture, kind of games and activities, and making things very visual and getting people out into the forest and getting people talking to each other, networking, you know, really, really creative ways of engaging people's imaginations. Because some people can read things, some people can watch PowerPoint presentations, a lot of people can't, and you know, we need to have ways of engagement different ways. We also use tools like Open Space, World Cafe, these kind of ways of bringing people, large groups of people together to self-organise and have conversations around certain issues. We use some of the more innovative internet-based things like using wikis and these kind of collaborative information building tools. We're also quite inspired by insights from the whole area of addictions and looking at the whole question of, can we compare our relationship to oil to an addiction? Do we have an addictive relationship to oil, to comfort, to our Western lifestyles? And I think there's a very strong case to say that we do, and that there are a number of insights that we can draw from the field of addictions which are very, very useful. And as environmentalists, we've been trying to instigate change for many years, but we've not been that good at understanding the processes of change. Whereas in addiction, there's some incredibly insightful work on change, the processes that people go through. And they argue that the processes people go through going into addiction are the same as the processes they go through coming out of addiction, and they're the same processes that any process of change goes through. The process where you're thinking, oh, there's no problem, I don't need to change, moving to, well, maybe there's a problem, maybe I need to do something over the next 6 months, but I'm not in a rush, then to, in the next month, I'm definitely going to do something. And they call that the pre-contemplation, the contemplation, and the preparation stage. Preparation stage being where you've decided you're going to do something, I'm definitely going to put solar panels on the roof, I'm going to do it, I've rung the guy, it's going to happen, I've put the money aside, I'm going to do that. And then that moves on to the action stage, which as environmentalists is where we want to get everybody to. But the insight that comes from looking at addictions theory is, assuming that everybody is at this stage of preparation, all we need to do is give them the right leaflet, lend them the right DVD, and they'll see the light and start doing everything, is deeply erroneous, because the majority of people are in the previous two stages, and they need very, very different stimulus. And the danger is that as environmentalists, if we're assuming that we just treat everybody as if they're at preparation stage, that we further and further alienate the people at the other stage and actually lessen their intention to respond. So we've had lots of dialogues with the people who are behind the idea of motivational interviewing, which is a tool from addictions, which is to do with helping people who are at the stage of trying to decide whether to leap or not. This kind of ambivalent period. And for an alcoholic, it would be, well, I know I drink a lot, but so do all my mates, and it's fine. Oh, well, my wife doesn't like it, but you know, she's all right. She doesn't mind it. And you'd go backwards and forwards. And so with this issue, it might be, well, I know oil's going to peak soon, but well, it hasn't peaked yet. And some people say it's not going to, but well, obviously it is, and we need to prepare and so on. And motivational interviewing is a very useful tool to apply at that stage to sort of support people through that. You would start by gathering together a small group of people who want to instigate this project, and the first thing that you do as that group is that you design the date when you're going to stop existing, so that you plan your own obsolescence into the process from the very beginning. And your role as that group is to organize and provide the awareness raising phase up to the point where you are ready to do this unleashing process. And you design that beyond that you don't exist. So you design your own Easter, as it were, where you just disappear. And I think that's really, really important. And so that then what happens is, so you spend the first year or first whatever, it's different for every place because there's different levels of awareness on these issues when you arrive. In some places it might be shorter, some places it might be longer. Here it was about a year. And that's the period wherein you show the end of suburbia, you show the power of community, you do talks, you get visiting speakers in, you make films, you show them around the place, you really try and build up that energy that this is a really important issue and we really need to move on this. And then you plan your official unleashing, which is the historic event where people look back and say that was the evening when it all started. And then you plan a program of events which trigger a number of your different groups starting to form. So, for example, we ran an evening called Feeding Totnes Past, Present and Future, where we had a speaker who talked about agriculture around this area in the 40s, 50s and 60s. Then we had someone who talked about the present, and then a local farmer talk about the role of organics in the future. And then that then led into an open space day on food, and from that the food group emerged. Then we did one on energy, an evening, an open space, and then the energy group emerged. So that's the kind of way we're doing it. And then the steering group for the project becomes a representative from each of those groups. So your steering group, rather than being made up of a sort of hand-picked group of experts, your steering group is the people who have made the commitment in their life that they're going to drive this forward, and it makes things much more dynamic. Then the process is that you're building up towards doing an energy descent plan, and that each of those groups is responsible for that aspect of the energy descent plan. That's roughly the idea. But it's important at an early stage as well that you start to put in place visible manifestations of the project. So for example, here in Totnes we're doing the tree plantings, the walnut tree plantings in the town. We're also in a couple of weeks launching a pilot local currency system where we're printing 300 Totnes pound notes, which will be usable within Totnes. There's about 20 businesses who've signed up that you can spend it there. You can spend it anywhere in transition town Totnes, but it's limited for about 3 or 4 months as a pilot to see how such a currency would work. But that's something which is very powerful. And I think one of the things that this process is doing is about creating new stories. And so the evening that we had that was the launch evening was about people telling the story of how Totnes makes this transition. And in fact, that's what an energy descent plan does, is it creates a vision of a powered down, abundant, localized Totnes in about 20, 30 years' time, and then it backcasts from there of how you actually get there. So you create a roadmap of how you can get there in realizable steps, year by year. If we collectively pull together, we can get from A to Z over that period of time. But one of the things, for example, that the local currency does, these printed notes will do, is it creates a story. It's something people have in their hands, and it's the potential. They hold that potential in their hands. And it's very, I think that would be a very powerful, tangible tool.
I think many people would say, well, are we really going to be able to support the numbers of people that we have right now, the population at the current levels?
Well, I think the answer to that question is no, if we want to live like we live now. If we want to live with a couple of cars and with all the latest gadgets and eating meat once a day, going on holiday abroad, you know, no. But I think there is a place that we can get to where we can do, and I would argue it would be a far healthier, more pleasant place to be. You know, when you look at the UK, for example, amazingly, there hasn't been a study done for the UK as to whether the UK could feed itself from its own land mass, its own agricultural land, since 1975. And that study said, well, we could do, but we'd have a diet similar to the one we had in World War II, and we'd eat a lot less meat. That period during the war, 1939-1945, was actually the time when the UK population was at its healthiest, even though it had the simplest diet of its time. Because it was eating much more locally produced vegetables from the 10% of the national diet at that time that was grown on allotments and back gardens and urban agriculture models. And that report from 1975, what it doesn't take into account is different ways of producing food. You know, it's very, very questionable that our current intensive agriculture model could actually support the number of people we have now, if you take away the cheap subsidised oil inputs and the amount of natural gas that's used to make fertilisers. But if you look at approaches like the bio-intensive approach, the very intensive urban market garden kind of model, you know, I think the figures are off the top of my head that they argue in the bio-intensive movement, argue that conventional agriculture requires about 10,000 square feet per person to provide their diet on an annual basis, whereas using bio-intensive approach, you bring it down to about 2,000, and you're doing it where people are. You know, it's such a profound rethink of everything. You know, well, it's the simple question, you know, can we support the population that we have? And yes, we can, but we have to rethink lots of very, very basic assumptions about how we eat, how we work, what our urban spaces look like. But quite clearly, also we need to start looking that we hit peak population pretty sharpish as well. Mm-hmm. We don't, you know, maybe we can sustain what we have now, but if we let it keep going up and up and up, then our chances of doing that get less and less all the time.
Mm-hmm. So you've mentioned food and energy. Are there other sectors or dimensions that you include in the visioning process?
Like transport.
Yeah. Well, I think it's very important. It's another of the reasons why I think peak oil is such a powerful motivator for this kind of movement, rather than climate change. That climate change can very easily be sidelined into being an issue about energy. It's about using less energy, carbon emissions from energy. Whereas when you work peak oil into it as well, you really develop the insight that everything that we do happens because cheap oil enables it to happen. It's not just about energy, it's about food, it's about economics and livelihoods, it's about education, health and medicine. One of the big things we're looking at here is how on earth do you move back to a healthcare system that doesn't rely on medicines that are made from petrochemicals, from equipment that is hugely dependent on petrochemicals. I'll come back to the health thing in a bit, but so we also look at transport, tourism. Totnes is a town very dependent on tourism. Will that tourism always be there? Will we have more tourists when people can't afford to fly on aeroplanes anymore? Or will we have less because people will be staying at home and enjoying being in their gardens so much they won't actually want to leave them in summer, which is the time when they need to be there watering and harvesting more than they do now? Building, construction, local government, how's local government going to work? You know, it cuts across all aspects of everything. And I think that's the power of bringing peak oil into it. And if I just say a little bit about the health and the medicine thing, I gave a talk a little while ago in Penzance for the Transition Town group there. And I said as part of that that one of the things that the health and medicine group in Totnes is doing is looking at the question of what are the 10 most frequently prescribed drugs in that doctors in Totnes give to people. Do they have a herbal or locally producible replacement? How much would we need? And to start thinking about building in place a kind of a local apothecary infrastructure, as it were, so that we actually have something to fall back on, because at the moment we don't. You know, and you look in Iraq now, for example, when the medical supplies stop coming in, it's extremely difficult because there's nothing to fall back on. There's no resilience in terms of the healthcare system. And I gave this talk, and this man came up at the end, and he said, "Oh, I'm a GP. I'm a doctor. I work here in Falmouth and in Penzance, and I've been sitting there listening to you." Talking, thinking, well, actually, the 10 drugs I prescribe most often are actually for side effects of cheap oil. I'd never thought about it before. But actually, I prescribe this drug, which is for obesity. I prescribe this drug, which is for excess stomach acid from overeating and eating the wrong food. I prescribe this drug, which is for stress. You know, he listed it all through, and he had this penny had dropped, you know, which was, yeah, he said, actually, the oil age makes people sick. You know, that actually so many of the diseases that we have now are diseases that are caused by the lifestyle that oil has brought us. And it's the myth that actually the oil age has brought us this fantastic progress and development and marvellous things. You know, actually, you can run alongside, and they did a very good study in Dublin, in Ireland, where they took the growth curve of the Irish economy and the growth curve of the amount of oil availability in Ireland, which mirror each other pretty much exactly. But then also mirroring that curve almost exactly are obesity rates, levels of heart disease, days off work from stress, the murder rate, the suicide rate, amounts of people admitted for clinical depression. You know, that all these things follow the same curve. And so in terms of healthcare and medicine and how we're going to respond to that, it's a huge question. But I think, again, if we can really rethink some basic assumptions, we can come to some very exciting conclusions.
So any last thoughts or words of advice or encouragement?
Yeah, I think that we find ourselves at an extraordinary point in history, and I for one find it an exhilarating time to be around. Really, you know, we can no longer ignore the signs that we have to do things. And on a scale that we've never done before, you know, we're faced with the most profound changes. And I think we have to really engage people in a way we've never engaged before. We have to inspire and enthuse people. And we're inviting people to join us on a collective adventure, to embark on a journey to something. And for me, I've been involved in environmental things for a long time. I was involved in protest against new roads being built in the UK in the 90s and anti-nuclear stuff in the 1980s. The danger with campaigning against stuff and always campaigning against stuff is that you come up against all the time the sort of the institutional refusal to shift. And as an activist, it's exhausting. And so many people get really burnt out by doing that kind of work. Whereas I find doing the transition town approach is working towards making the same kind of change, but it's so nourishing, and as someone doing it, it really feeds you, and you get so much from seeing the kind of enthusiasm that it generates, because it avoids that them and us dynamic, and it comes in underneath the radar. An expression by Jean de Buffet, who is an artist, used to say that art never lies down in the bed that's made for it, and its best moments are when it forgets what it's called. And I think this process has that sort of playful kind of nature, and it can put on different hats for who it's meeting, and it can put on a suit and tie and go along and speak to the council, and it can put on wellies and go and talk to farmers, and it can go into the schools, and it can go and talk to the, you know, it really has to have that ability to draw people in. And I think you can do that so much more effectively by being for something rather than being against something. And I think the power of creating collective visions of where we want to go, creating a roadmap of how it could be in such a way that people can smell it and feel it and almost taste it. If you threw your window open in the morning in 2025 in a powered down relocalized Totnes, living in a powered down world, what would it be like? What would it sound like when you look out? What would you have for breakfast? What would you hear as you walk down the street? Where would you go? You know, and I think when there's so much stuff that's bubbling up for people saying, oh, peak oil, climate change, overpopulation, you know, that actually something which can really, really present that is very, very powerful. One of my favourite quotes is Arundhati Roy, who's an Indian novelist, who says, another world is not only possible, she is on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing.
That was Rob Hopkins of the Transition Towns Movement speaking in 2007. To find out the latest on the many towns and cities that have taken up the challenge and how to start the process in your town, visit transitiontowns.org. For local listeners and those in the Northeast interested in studying permaculture, the Finger Lakes Permaculture Institute will be offering a course of permaculture fundamentals over a weekend in Montour Falls, New York, beginning Friday, April 24th at dinner time through Sunday, April 26th. The course will cover the basics of permaculture design and allow students to walk away with a toolbox of ecological design principles. It will offer a discussion on the ethics, attitudes, and principles of permaculture, as well as an exploration of natural ecology and the patterns that lead to regenerative designs. Tuition is on a sliding scale, and overnight accommodations are also available. For more information, visit fingerlakespermaculture.org. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton, Bealeton, KSOW, Cottage Grove, or WMRW, Warren. Project Okanox was organized by members of the free software movement to bring together people to explore whether the application of the economic and political principles of free software development could be the foundation of a new economy as the basis for a new society. Our next speaker was one of those presenting at the 4th annual conference held last month in Manchester, UK, and comes to us courtesy of Sheffield Indie Media. We've been told repeatedly that technological development and production requires intellectual property, the profit motive, centralized economies of scale, and hierarchies of command and control. Not true. Open source ecology is a movement dedicated to the collaborative development of the world's first replicable, open source, modern, off-grid global village. By using permaculture and digital fabrication together to provide for basic needs, and open source methodology to allow cheap replication of the entire village, they hope to empower anyone who desires to move beyond the struggle for survival and evolve to freedom.
Our next speaker is Marcin Jakubowski from Missouri, USA. He is a doctor of physics by education. His thesis was about atomic fusion. So he is a technologist of wide scope. And he's done almost the opposite of what he was supposed to do by his studies. He reinvented a physical support system that really makes something like self-determined living possible. And that's a gigantic task, a task that is composed by many different components. And I'm very curious how you will react to this endeavor, which I hope will work as a community of villages all around the world.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so please take one of the little handouts. You can look at it online, openfarmtech.org/weblog. It's the post. This talk is a post that's on the 26th of March. So if you have a computer, you can look at this too. What we'll do is I'll introduce the topic. We're going to go to a little 10-minute video. I wasn't planning on that, but since we've got all the sound and video, we can view that just to get you a real picture of what we're doing on the ground, because we've got some theory and some practice to boot. So the talk today is about building the world's first replicable, open-source, off-grid, global village to basically transcend the survival and evolve to freedom. That's a big task. We're talking about re-engineering civilization. I want to go a little bit into what this all means. Global village. What is this packed term? First of all, global village. We're talking about a globally linked community, but also with a real economy, a real village. Okay. Off-grid, we mean, we're not talking about not having electricity. That's one way to go off-grid. Or buying some expensive solar panels to provide your electricity if you can have the money. We're talking about, no, we're not talking about that. We're talking about building our own solar power system. Plus getting off-grid on the financial systems and on the productive systems in terms of 100% local food, energy, housing, and fabrications capacity on a small scale. So this is SMARIs, the small scale republics, all that kind of stuff. This is a natural fallout of this. Open source, we know what that means. Open documentation is what it's about. We document all our work. And replicable, that's a big one. To make something replicable, not only do you have to be open source, but you have to teach people and be able to capitalize the physical infrastructure. So if you develop optimal, low-cost means to do this, you're in business. That's what we mean by our term. So today we've done some physical work in terms of, I'll explain the whole construction set, but let's just watch a video to see what we've done on the ground so far. It covers the building and construction and agricultural implement side of things.
Here's a little story of our building adventures at Factory Farm, which leads up to the present work with the CV Press. We started with raw land and built an earth-bagged structure 2 years ago. We built the cordwood addition a year after that. Turns out earth-bagged building and cordwood building is both difficult work. All along, I've been thinking that compressed earth bricks are the best. They're strong, they're fast to build with, and they're 100% natural. What more could I ask for? So here came the CEB press, the compressed earth block press. I took some metal from the custom fab shop, a bunch of drill holes, and a tad of welding, plugged this into the tractor, fired it up, and pressed the first brick. We moved out to test the CEB press in a field. We built ourselves an open source tractor first, because we weren't satisfied with the industrial tractors that just kept breaking. So with our new tractor, which we call the Life-Giving Lifetime Design Life Track, we began to build. We started to build an addition right behind the stick frame greenhouse, so the greenhouse would not be blown over by winds that huff and puff quite strongly around here.